Just want to cozy it up. Don't need to make it. Two putts.
How about one? In one of the most unlikely final round Sundays in U.S. Open history, J.J. Spahn closes the deal with a birdie at the last. You could have never dreamt this Sunday for Spahn.
Well, it doesn't get any more dramatic on the 72nd hole of a major championship than a 64-foot putt falling in the cup, setting off a chaotic scene at Oakmont Country Club on Sunday evening as J.J. Spahn punctuated his victory at the 125th U.S. Open Championship. Thanks to NBC Sports for that audio with Dan Hicks and Kevin Kisner, and welcome to a U.S. Open recap here on Musings on Golf. I'm Kelly Elbin, my co-host. Bob Bupka is off this week, but I am thrilled to welcome Mark Rolfing of NBC Sports and Golf Channel, who spent his fourth U.S. Open week at Oakmont, one of the great clubs in our country. Mr. Rolfing, welcome back to Musings on Golf. Hey, Mark, thanks for joining us. Once again, Oakmont, and in this case, J.J. Spahn, really delivered when it mattered most.
It really did. It's pretty automatic with Oakmont. I left the week being pretty convinced that Oakmont is the most comprehensive test in championship golf. It's definitely the hardest. And that test of golf was just unbelievable. The word that I use for it is relentless. And the best part about it all was I was on the morning show every day for live from the U.S. Open, which meant when the leaders teed off on the weekend, my day was done working and I got to become a golf fan because it was just fascinating, intriguing, bizarre. I've used a lot of different words for it, but it was all those.
It really was with the break because of the rain, which JJ clearly said benefited him in a huge way. Hey, Mark, let me begin with that last putt. And I'm wondering from your perspective, the very fact that Victor Hovland had almost literally the same putt, the same line as JJ. In your opinion, does JJ Spahn make that putt if he doesn't have that look immediately preceding him from Victor?
It's hard to really say, but there's no question that having that line really helped. These guys are so good that once they see a line, they can pretty much start the ball online. That doesn't mean it's going to go in from 64 feet. And if you look at that putt that J.J. Spahn hit, it was still going pretty fast. I'm convinced, and I haven't heard a lot of talk about it, but I'm pretty convinced he was going to have 5 or 6 feet coming back had that thing not gone in the hole. When something like that happens, there's some fate involved. There's no question about it. You look at what happened to J.J. throughout that entire round. It's almost like Oakmont owed him something. He hit the shot of his life, obviously, off the 17th tee. But the putt, I think, had a little bit of fate to it. It was going too fast, but having that line definitely helped him.
Mark, I'm interested in your opinion on where that putt, considering the circumstances, as a putt, not a chip-in like we had with Tiger at the Masters or Watson at 82 at the U.S. Open, where does that putt rank all-time in major championship history? Is it maybe right there with Tiger's putt to tie Rocco and get into the playoff out in Southern California?
Well, let's see. Tiger's putt was only, 10 or 12 feet. Yeah, so 64 feet is quite a bit different. I don't go that far back that I can rank some of the earlier putts. I think the putting generally is easier now because the greens are in such good condition and they're faster. I think that green would have been harder to putt and much more difficult had the putt been a lot slower. So, is it the greatest putt to win a major? I don't know if I can say that, but it's in the top five. There's no question about that.
Right. You talked about Oakmont right from the start. I'm wondering your impressions of Oakmont going in, having been there three times prior, and then your impressions coming out. Was it exactly as you had anticipated by the end of the week as you had going into the U.S. Open in terms of the challenge, the rough, the speed of the greens, and everything put together?
I think it was there was one more element that came into play that I wasn't sort of expecting, and that was the weather and the wetness and the condition that was caused by that. So that was a little different. But I had said early in the week on Live Front that I thought the elements of the game that were going to be more important at Oakmont were a little different from most U.S. Opens, where your strokes gained approach, you know, being able to hit all the greens in regulation and get it close when you could is typically the most important element. At Oakmont, that's not the case. At Oakmont, it's twofold. It's driving and it's putting. And that's really what ended up happening. If you take a look at all the players that had a chance to win, their downfall typically was in the driving category. Some of the best drivers in the world just simply couldn't perform with the driver when they really needed to at Oakmont. The fairways are so narrow, so slopey, so hard to hit. And then the one guy that delivered on the putting when he really needed to was J.J. Spaun. So I think it's a little different than most U.S. Open venues, and driving and putting are definitely the most important.
Hey, Mark, I want to ask, you know, your thoughts about JJ down the stretch. But in general, how well did you know JJ Spaun and his background, his story before last week?
Oh, I do it pretty well. I watched him play a lot of golf. I wouldn't say I know him that well personally, but I know him pretty well professionally. And there's a lot of his game that I really, really like. He is one of the most reliable ball strikers in terms of shot shape that I have seen in a long, long time. He hits this baby fade that's not a slice. It's just a sort of a butter fade, and it's really, really a cool shot, and it is very, very reliable. I was amazed a year ago right now that he wasn't doing better than he was. I had thought after kind of a breakthrough a few years ago, he was on his way, but there was a point. It shows you what a fine line it is in this game between being a great player and just an average player. And there was a point a year ago where he was thinking he might actually lose his job. So this was a tremendous comeback for him.
Psychologically, professional golf at that level can beat you down. It can be very hard on your belief system. And it sounds like he dealt with that, Mark, in terms of, am I good enough to play with these guys? Can I really do it? And that's, there's a lot to be said for resiliency when it's just you as opposed to being part of a team, Mark.
And there is, but you know, he's got a lot of great people around him, his family number one, that have been very supportive of him. And you know, he's got a lot of really good friends. Everybody likes J.J. Spaun, and I saw somewhere that Kevin Kisner provided some, you know, counsel for him and really kind of try to help convince J.J. just how good he was. In a lot of ways, it reminds me of the guy that's dominating the game right now, Scottie Scheffler, who, if you look back to prior to the Ryder Cup at Whistling Straits, Scottie Scheffler had not found the kind of success, you know, that we're seeing now by any means. But he also was not a very confident player. He had no idea how good he was. And it really took, I think, getting named to that Ryder Cup team and having all the players on that team saying they wanted him as their partner to kind of show him how good he was and how good they thought he was. And that just catapulted him. And I think JJ was in the same boat. JJ could be very hard on himself. I think he still can be very hard on himself. His tendency is to beat himself up, and the game's hard enough that you don't want to do that any more than you really need to. So I think the confidence thing really has helped him, and that's probably what turned the corner for him.
Mark, let's focus a little bit on those putts. And you mentioned about the baby fade off the tee on 17, but that first putt he made on 12, he basically just tapped it, Mark, and it just kept rolling and then goes in, makes a lengthy putt at 14. I mean, yeah, there's one thing about resilience and so forth. As you said, this talented guy. I mean, Mark, those putts at 12, 14, and 18 were off the chart impressive putts in crucial, tough situations.
I read somewhere, I'm not sure this is exactly the case, but I think it's pretty close. I read somewhere that J.J. Spaun made more feet of putts in the last 7 holes than anybody else did for the round. he made like 130 feet of putts in those last seven holes, which is just absolutely incredible. And look, you know, for a putt to go in from that far, going at the pace it did on a green that has that much slope, there's got to be a little bit of luck involved and certainly a lot of fate. So I'm a big believer in fate, and he had it with him there.
Hey, let's hear what, you know, fate and all. Let's hear from J.J. Spahn, the new U.S. Open champion, in terms of the game plan that he had going into what turned out to be a magical week at Oakmont.
Just let it come to you. Be calm. You know, just stop trying so hard. And that's what I was doing, you know, like I felt like I had a chance, a really good chance to win the U.S. Open, you know, at the start of the day, and it just unraveled very fast. But, you know, that break was actually the key for me to winning this tournament.
Yeah, it's rare, isn't it, Mark, that a rain delay and a pretty lengthy one at that played such a monumental role in the outcome of a major championship.
Well, it did, and it really did both ways, Kelly. If you think about it, we're talking about JJ, who played extremely well after the rain delay, but there were some guys that the rain delay absolutely stopped any momentum they had, and that didn't respond very well coming back. But listening to that quote reminds me of my fabulous friend and colleague, Roger Maltby, who says a lot, you know, golf isn't really that hard. It only gets hard when you care. And, you know, isn't that the truth? And I think that's where JJ has been. But I like the fact that he's trying to let the game come to him a little bit more. He knew that he could make a three at 17. And that's why I'm going to go back to that. That will be the shot of his life. I truly believe the tee shot that he hit at 17 was the greatest shot he's ever hit in his life up to that point. And I'm not sure he'll ever hit another one that's any better than that one.
And it fed right into his that type of shape that he plays. It was perfect for him. But Mark, to pull that off under those circumstances, it shows everything about his game and his him as a person.
Really does. He looked totally calm on the tee, took a tremendous swing at it. But so much can go wrong on that tee shot. If you take a look at what happened to Victor Hovland over the weekend at 17, some of the places that he got it there, and Tyrrell Hatton is just a tiny, tiny target up there. You know, standing back on that tee, you're looking up at this infinity kind of green. You see the top of the flag, and that's about it. That opening up there can't be 10 yards wide, hardly, to squeeze that drive into. But he did it, and that will be the shot of his life.
I also liked what he said and how you reacted to it, and with him saying, stop trying so hard. We had Dr. Bob Rotella on the week after Rory won the Players' Championship, and Rory obviously said some very nice things about Bob and his role in helping Rory maybe what? Not think so hard, not put so much pressure. It's a classic case, right? If your mind's in a certain place, Mark, on a very difficult golf course in a really hard game to begin with, you can achieve great things, but your mind's got to get there, right?
Well, and you got to have the confidence in knowing that you're good enough to be able to do it. That's what will give you patience to let something happen as opposed to trying to make something happen. Because as soon as you start trying to make something happen out there at Oakmont, what you're going to make happen is a lot of disaster. Because there are so many times out there that you just have to play away from a target that looks like it's gettable that it's really not. But you really need to have the confidence that you can wait and not have that be the moment where you win the U.S. Open. And it might not be in the next hole. It might not be in the next hole after that. But it will come if you can be patient and wait.
Let's hear a little bit more from JJ in regards to, he seems to me to be a very grounded person. Let's hear a little bit about how he got into golf and certainly not one who played a lot of country club golf and AJGA, et cetera. Very basic beginnings into the game, according to JJ.
I grew up watching golf. I was a young kid, wanted to play golf. I loved golf. It was a passion for me growing up. And, you know, always played with my parents growing up. And, you know, one thing led to another. I didn't really wasn't really groomed to be like a professional golfer. I didn't, you know, get put through academies. I didn't play the AJGA. I played local stuff. I did qualify for actually my first big USGA event, which was the US Junior. I did that two times when I was like 16 and 17. And that's kind of when I realized my potential. But I just kept going like one foot in front of the other and, you know, junior golf, college golf, turning pro, and now here I am with the US Open trophy.
Mark, his story, and JJ, the more I listen to him, Mark Rolfing, the more I like him and how he's developed in the game and the type of person he is.
He is grounded. There's no question about it. That's a great word to use for JJ Spahn. And how does he keep himself grounded? To this day, you can find him out on a public course playing with just some random people that he might get paired with or practicing out there. He doesn't do it all the time, but he does it enough that I think it's an important part of his whole process. And when asked about why he does that, he says, that's what keeps me grounded because that's where he came from. And he was actually had the potential to be a professional skateboarder. He was a guy that was known for taking a lot of chances, which you have to do in skateboarding, trying, you know, some maneuvers and things that are really hard to do and pull off. And I'm sure he crashed and burned a lot of times. It's exactly the opposite of U.S. Open type golf. So for him to make the transition from the mentality of being a skateboarder to a U.S. Open champion is pretty amazing.
It couldn't be any more different. We're going to continue in just a little bit with Mark Rolfing, who we're so pleased to have with us here on Musings on Golf. Mark covered his fourth U.S. Open at Oakmont. You see him regularly on NBC Sports and Golf Channel, and they're live from at all the major championships. We'll hear more from Mark right after these good words from our corporate friends at William & Harry and Titleist. William & Harry has entered a bold new era, led by their new Lionhead logo, a symbol of strength, leadership, and fearless ambition. Step onto the course with purpose, outplay the field, and dominate your opponent, while wearing handcrafted shoes that blend performance, luxury, and unmistakable style. William & Harry offers custom designs featuring your club, company, or organization's logo, so you stand out with every step. Visit williamandharry.com and use code 15OFFMOG for 15% off. William & Harry, walk with the lion.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee. More control with your irons. More spin with your wedges. And more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Well, we're back with Mark Rolfing. Mark, you mentioned the rain delay and kind of the flip side of JJ Spahn. Let's talk a little bit about some of those guys who didn't quite get to the finish line. I'll start, you know, in a very positive way there with Robert McIntyre. I mean, there's a guy who's really emerged, Mark, over the last couple of years on the international golf scene. He wins in Canada, wins on his home soil in Scotland, runner-up finish at the U.S. Opens. Your impressions about Bob McIntyre?
Yeah, Bob McIntyre is kind of new to my professional life. I first really watched him a lot at the Ryder Cup in Rome, where I will tell you early in the week, and that was what? That's only been not even 2 years now, but early in that week, he was scared to death. He was literally in a panic. His game wasn't nearly as tight as it is now, but he had made it on that team. And literally, Justin Rose's job that week, and one of the reasons that he was on that Ryder Cup team for Europe, was to kind of watch over and help and guide Robert McIntyre. And he, Justin, did a really good job, which is no surprise there. And McIntyre thrived in that Ryder Cup atmosphere. So that really helped him. And he grew into what is a terrific player. He's a great driver of the golf ball now, and can really, under the most pressure, hit some really good tee shots. So I like his chances a lot. If I were Keegan Bradley right now, I would be really worried about Bethpage in September, because, you know, you always talk about the top of that European lineup and everybody points toward McIlroy and, you know, John Rahm and that kind of player. But you get down into the middle of that lineup and even down toward the bottom and you see, you know, these guys like Robert McIntyre, man, he is good. And that European team is going to be deep. They're going to be stacked and they're going to be tough to beat.
Yeah, I was going to say, Donald's got to be very happy right now. You have with Victor Hovland, who we mentioned earlier, finished third. Tyrrell Hatton, tied for fourth. We're inside 3 months from Bethpage and the Ryder Cup. But Mark, the consistent play, if you just look at it for the two teams, the consistent play has been on the European side in big events so far. As you said, it's right now shapes up to be a very deep team, and they would be the favorites, seems to me, going into Bethpage.
Oh, I definitely think they're the favorites going into Bethpage. And one of the guys on that team that I'm really going to point toward is Victor Hovland, because, you know, Hovland is just amazing. He is a guy that's so hard to figure out, but he's got it figured out. He can have stretches where he plays some of the worst golf you've ever seen. He can be totally lost. I've been on the set with him on Live From, where he said he had no idea how to chip and putt. And isn't it cool that he can shoot such good scores with having such a terrible short game? His attitude, I'll tell you, Kelly, if there was a strokes gained attitude category, he would lead it by far. It wouldn't even be close. And even this week at Oakmont, he called it a fun challenge. He was the only guy that I heard all week long use the word fun, because the US Open is not supposed to be fun. But I'll tell you, if you decide that what you're going to do is get into a fight with Oakmont, you're going to lose every single time. You can't do that. You've got to embrace the challenge. And it seems like no matter what the challenge is, whether it's a Ryder Cup or a US Open, Victor Hovland embraces it.
I'm with you on Hovland. And I'm wondering also with Tyrrell Hatton, if he might look back and say, boy, I really grew up a lot during that 2025 US Open. I mean, the guy who all we've ever heard is short fuse, prone to outbursts, etc. He seemed very patient. Which you said earlier, that's such a key at Oakmont. Tyrrell Hatton seemed to grow up a lot at this past major championship, Mark.
Yeah, I don't think his attitude changed and his fuse was just as short. But the way he grew up was that he began to realize why the U.S. Open is such a tremendous opportunity for him, because every other player is in that same boat. He's that way all year long, every tournament. It doesn't matter whether it's the Portugal Open or the U.S. Open. That's the way he is going to react to situations. And a lot of times I think it works to his detriment to be like that, because he's a tremendously talented player. But what he saw in the U.S. Open is that all these other guys were doing it and kind of lost their minds, and that actually gave him an advantage.
Among those other guys who struggled, and it was really a shame for Sam Burns, because he had played so well, but those last, six or seven holes after the rain delay, Mark, is this possibly a case, though, for Sam, that it's a learning lesson? Young guy has, again, all the talent in the world. Is this something he finds a positive from in moving forward?
Oh, I think so. That's the kind of guy Sam Burns is and the type of player he is. I had said on the Sunday morning show before he teed off, I was really worried about his driving. I didn't know that his driving could hold up. And that's kind of been a pattern throughout his career. Sam Burns, Kelly, has become the best putter in the game, I believe. You know, that's a mantle that Denny McCarthy has held for, three, 4 years, I'd say?
Sir, yeah.
But I think Sam Burns is the best putter now. he just could not figure out how to get the ball in play coming down the stretch. And that cost him, because you can't hit the kind of shutouts that he hit. And it's just so predictable. And it's so easy to have happen, because the same exact thing happened to Adam Scott, who was one of the great drivers in the game.
Yeah.
And he just could not get the ball in the fairway. He totally, I thought, lost track of what he was doing out there. He missed a couple of shorter putts, but in the end, Adam Scott drove the ball terribly coming down the stretch, particularly after the rain delay. And that's where the two guys who I think, you know, had a really good chance, either one of them. Sam Burns had a 2-shot lead at the 11th hole. You just got to figure out how to get the ball in play no matter what.
Mark, on TV, it came across that Adam Scott was kind of the sentimental choice. His age, number of majors he's played, and only having won the Masters. It was sort of the vibe there that a lot of people were kind of hoping that somehow Adam Scott would pull this out.
Yeah, I mean, how do you not root for Adam Scott? He's just a tremendous man, tremendous human being. And he has worked really, really hard. You know, he's almost 45 years old now. He's 44. And this will be one of the last, you know, chances he has, I think, legitimately to win a U.S. Open like that. It's interesting. I've watched Adam for a long, long time throughout his career. He has a lot of Justin Rose in him. Both of those players, when they came out on the PGA Tour, they were like elegant swingers of the golf club, and they had the most beautiful swings and didn't generate a lot of power. Adam Scott probably has a swing that's emulated more than any other by instructors around America to show what good tempo can do and what can show when you don't have any moving parts in a swing. But Adam Scott literally has formed his game from being an elegant player into a power player. He has worked really, really hard. He'd had, I think, the tee shot on Saturday that he hit off the 18th tee. The ball speed was 187 miles an hour, which is amazing for a 44-year-old. And he's adapted to the game. He's worked really hard. He still thinks he can win a major. But he's running out of time. You better make it happen pretty quick here.
You mentioned how much of a class guy he is. I thought him, you know, hugging J.J. Spahn and really congratulating him was very cool. And I thought Bob McIntyre clapping, being on camera, Mark, after Spahn, cool was that? How much did that show you about Bob McIntyre?
Yeah, that showed me a whole lot about Bob McIntyre. Because, you know, really, I don't care whether J.J. Spahn saw the exact line or not. I really think in that situation with the U.S. Open on the line, you're going to three-putt that thing more than you're going to make it. Definitely, you're going to three-putt it more than you're going to make it. But he made it.
And to see McIntyre congratulated him was really cool. Putting the finishing touches on a terrific time, recapping the U.S. Open with our friend Mark Rolfing of NBC Sports and Golf Channel. Let's touch on Rory McIlroy for a minute. And I don't want to get into the whole thing about whether he owes media interviews or not. I'm wondering, are we likely to simply see, because of the return of the Open Championship to his homeland at Royal Portrush, are we likely, Mark, to see a more, quote, motivated Rory McIlroy for the final two majors, for the final major of the year, than maybe we've seen for the last two majors?
I hope so. I hope we do. And frankly, I wish he wasn't playing this week. I really think Rory needs a vacation. I said a couple of times during the week, he's in a mental vacuum right now, and it is totally understandable. I'm going to give him a pass on it because there was just so much relief. Forget the exhilaration of winning the Grand Slam. The relief had to be just incredible. And he hasn't really had much downtime to do it. You know, when you climb Everest, as he said, and you start coming down, you got to find another mountain to climb. And I think that's been difficult for him. And it wasn't going to be the U.S. Open from the beginning. You know, it's not really his style of golf course. I don't think he likes Oakmont that much. He had driver issues of all kinds going into there, but the bottom line and most important part of it was he wasn't driving the ball very well, which, is kind of the instigator of the rest of his game. If he can totally get away, I'd love to see him for a couple of weeks after this week, just get away and get himself mentally refreshed and start thinking about what it would be like for him to win at Port Rush and have him start thinking about what went wrong the last time he was there, hitting it out of bounds off the first tee, for example. You just can't make mistakes like that and win an Open. But I think his mental attitude has got to be totally different going in there. He's got to really want it. And I tend to think he will get there, but he needs a little time off in order to do that.
Mark, a couple things before we close. Restructuring of the PGA Tour at the very top. Brian Rolapp, who had been the NFL's chief media and business officer for a number of years, is now the new CEO of the PGA Tour. That means he will take over PGA Tour Inc. and PGA Tour Enterprises. And the current commissioner, Jay Monahan, is transitioning to be more involved with the policy board and PGA Tour Enterprises board through 2026. Mark, I wasn't clear if that means Jay will be fully stepping down from everything at the end of 2026, but perhaps could you provide some clarity as to what these significant moves at the top of the hierarchy of the PGA Tour mean?
Well, most importantly, Kelly, is that Brian is now the CEO of PGA Tour Enterprises, which is the for-profit arm that the PGA Tour is involved in. And it's given the PGA Tour a totally different view on the world. And that's the way the other major leagues all operate. Every single one of them is a for-profit. And, if you take a look at SSG, the company that invested $1.5 billion in the PGA Tour, and they've got another $1.5 billion in reserve, they don't do that, as a charitable donation. Yeah. They're looking for an investment. And the search committee that was involved in hiring Brian was really headed up by Arthur Blank, the owner of the Atlanta Falcons, among other things, who, along with Steve Cohen of SSG, those are really dominant guys. And they are tremendous businessmen and, some of the leaders in sports. And part of the reason why the NFL has become such a powerful organization and entity. And Brian has had a lot to do that. He is one of the most powerful and most respected businessmen in the entire world of sports. And what he has done at the NFL has been very unnoticed because he's not the kind of guy that toots his own horn. But he is now going to be an out front guy on the PGA Tour. So what does that mean for Jay? Look, I think the issue for Jay has been he has lost confidence from a lot of the players. And I think it was almost totally due to the way the negotiations with the Saudis and PIF were held, kind of behind closed doors. And the players on the PGA Tour didn't know what's going on when that happened. And now there's a new leader, Brian. So, is Jay going to stay around? It's hard for me to say. I mean, the role of commissioner of the PGA Tour will clearly be diminished in terms of the importance and really the decision-making. Will it be celebratory? I don't know. It's hard to say. If it's celebratory, maybe Jay stays for a little while. But if it's a big role in a decision-making role, I wouldn't be surprised to see him gone by the end of next year.
Mark, if you look at the two gentlemen who preceded Jay to that role with Dean Beaman and Tim Fincham, both elected ultimately to the World Golf Hall of Fame, we're kind of painting a very different picture, I think, of how Jay Monahan may be viewed his tenure when he's all said and done.
I think so, but they were three different guys when you think about it. And, following Dean Beaman and Tim Fincham, you talk about some tough footsteps to follow, and they were both tremendous leaders. Dean was one of the most decisive men I've ever met in my life. Yeah. He was really, really good at that. Tim was a businessman, and the way he viewed the PGA Tour was totally from a business aspect. And he was extremely successful and led the PGA Tour through some difficult transition times. But Jay, when Jay came along, Jay was more of a marketing kind of a guy. He had been involved in PGA Tour golf tournaments and running them and marketing them, and was really, really good at that. And I think he still did a very, very good job at that. I think more than anything, where he probably fell down, particularly in the last couple of years, and most people would have succumbed to this, is that his communication with all the members on the PGA Tour was not what they wanted. They felt like the PGA Tour was not being run by the players. It's their organization, they feel. And I think that's why he suffered a little bit, really. But I don't think his legacy is going to be that tarnished. I think people are still going to look at him because he's such a good guy and so well-respected that nobody's going to say, oh, what a horrible commissioner Jay Monahan was. He was not. He was a good commissioner.
Two more things before we go. And speaking of great guys, you and your lovely bride, Debbie, recipients of the 2017 PGA of America Distinguished Service Awards, the highest honor that the association bestows for all of your work in fostering. I wonder if you could maybe give our listeners an update, Mark, on the number of people you fostered and what that continues to mean to you and Debbie. And just a one-off from that, that commitment that the two of you made together, that was something I would imagine if a husband and wife today were looking to foster kids, that's something that you both, Mark, have to be extremely committed to, understanding everything that comes with it, right?
Well, you have to be committed, and I also think you need to understand what your roles are. And in this situation, it was pretty clear from the beginning that Debbie was going to be the player and I was going to be the caddy. She's the one who's really been responsible for doing so much of the work, particularly when I was traveling around doing my other job. And so as long as I knew that my job was to be the caddy, I had to be the best caddy I could. But she has been just a phenomenal player, Hall of Famer there.
Final question. Typically, I'll ask, who would be a dream foursome who you would play with? But I want to change it up a little bit because I watched again the interview that you did with Mr. Palmer after the 94 Open, after the very emotional send-off. And I'm wondering, Mark, if you could just speak to that for a second of what that was like for you to be holding the mic for ESPN as Arnold came off the 18th green and the incredible emotions from that time, what that was like for you as a relatively young broadcaster to be face-to-face with the king.
Yeah, that was 1994, Kelly. Arnold and I had gotten very close in the 80s when he was designing a couple of golf courses out in Hawaii at Kapalua. And in a lot of ways, he became sort of a mentor to me. He mentored me through the early part of my career. And in 94, he was toward the end of his career. And obviously, that was going to be an emotional moment. We knew it, that it was a chaotic day at Oakmont. The world of sports was just totally upside down. The Rangers in New York were celebrating a Stanley Cup. The Knicks and the Rockets were in game five, I think it was, of the NBA playoff. And, at about noon, when we had totally planned out this interview and we were all set to do it at about 2:55 Eastern, at noon was right after O.J. Simpson got indicted and became a fugitive. So it was pretty clear that interview was not going to happen and probably shouldn't have happened because we were supposed to go to a live World Cup soccer game on ESPN at 3:00, the first time the World Cup had ever been played in America. And it was the President of the United States and Oprah Winfrey and all this stuff in Chicago. And so at about 2:57, when Arnold hadn't come out of the scoring yet, I got the word from my producer that the interview was off. Can't do it. We got to go to the soccer. And I was disappointed. And I thought, how am I going to explain to Arnold if he does come out? Well, he came out, made a beeline straight to me. And Chris Berman, who was supposed to be throwing to the soccer game, saw this on one of his monitors. And he couldn't help himself either because he's a fan at heart and said, oh, Arnold Palmer's going straight to Mark Rolfing. We got to go down to Mark Rolfing. So he threw it to me when, in fact, nobody wanted him to, and he wasn't supposed to. And there I was. I, for however long that whole thing took, forgot that I was actually interviewing. I became a fan again.
Yeah.
And I had a whole lot of people telling me what I ought to do and how I ought to get him to say something and grab him or do something. Everybody was saying in the mobile unit, because they wanted to get this thing over with. But I wasn't about to. And that will be probably one of my, well, that might be my top memory, but it's very close. Seemed like a minute, you know, took 10 minutes. But it's a moment I'll never forget, that's for sure.
Well, you had lovely words of parting to Arnie on behalf of, you know, golfers everywhere, millions of golfers. Thank you. I thought that was, it was very poignant, and you could tell that there was a bond that the two of you had going into that. It wasn't just some announcer talking to Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, that's for sure. I took my headset off after that interview and went and sat down under a tree, which I went to the other day at Oakmont. I actually took Damon Hack, who was my host on the early Live From show out there, because he wanted to know, where was that tree that I've heard this story about? And we walked over to it, and I actually, at that time, back in 94, just took my headset off and walked over there and sat down and cried my eyes out. I knew that it was an amazing moment, but even now, you know, 31 years later, it's more amazing to me.
This has been an amazing time with us. Mark, thank you so much for your thoughts and your comments about this U.S. Open. It was one for the ages. Very happy personally for J.J. Spahn to have won, and very happy for you that you're able to enjoy a fourth Open at a most special place when it comes to hosting U.S. Opens, Mark.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, Kelly, and my best to Bob.